Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Neil Rewind podcast on war and violence. My name is Anne Vermaudijk and today I speak with Professor Jacob Ekeler, who in October 2021 got assigned Professor of Modern and Contemporary History of the Netherlands, as well as the Director of the Center of Netherlands Studies at the University of Münster in Germany. Welcome to Neil Rewind, Jacco, and congratulations on your wonderful new position.
Yeah, thanks, Anne.
Before we talk about the content of your work, can you maybe take a minute or two and introduce yourself?
Yes, okay. So my name is Jacco Pekeler. I am a historian. I've studied history at Utrecht University and oriented towards German history and especially the Dutch relations with Germany and the Dutch reactions to the unification of Germany in the 19th century. Then I got a job as PhD student studying the Dutch relations with the German Democratic Republic. Then I did some parliamentary history of the Netherlands, also building ties, by the way, with German colleagues. So Germany keeps pulling me all through my life or career. And then I went to the German Institute in Amsterdam, where I spent only 6 years, but it seems a very intense time. And then I developed another line of research on political violence and terrorism, especially the social and political dynamics of terrorist crises in West Germany in the 1970s, of course, focused on that, but also sometimes in a more general way. And then I switched to Utrecht again, international relations, but I continued this violent way of performing my career. And then I went to, so my last step, as you already said, was the switching to Münster University and focusing again more on Dutch-German relationships instead of violence as a general theme. But of course, it always plays a part in not only in Dutch-German relations, but also in the relations of Germany and Europe on a wider scale.
Yeah. About your new position as head of the Center of Netherlands Studies, which is based, if I'm right, at the border region of North Rhine-Westphalia, close to the Netherlands. In this position, you deal with the relationship between Germany and the Netherlands. And I was wondering, what are your future plans for research?
Yeah, so in a more fundamental sense, I want to expand the study of the relations between the Netherlands and Germany to a more European scale, make it also easier to do comparative research by looking into the way how, including of course the Netherlands, but how six European neighboring nations of the Germans viewed the efforts to create a unified, strong Germany in the middle of our continent around the mid-19th century. So before Bismarck eventually indeed created this new German Empire, how they viewed the enthusiasm of a lot of Germans for the idea of national unification, how they maybe even greeted the efforts to create more a more liberal Germany by the Germans, but also how they tried to steer that process, because I had the hunch that these Europeans often were more positive about this prospect of a strong and unified Germany in their midst than we, in hindsight, with the First World War especially, but then the Second World War in mind, think is at all feasible. We think, how can this be?
Polish they weren't people, afraid for hegemonic
sure,
Germany?
Sure, that was always on their mind. But at the same time, even, let's say, wild as Polish nationalists that wanted to restore a strong and independent Poland, even they, for at least for about two decades, were quite positive about German unification, because they thought this would create a strong bulwark against Russian hegemony in the eastern parts of Europe, and would enable them to be supported also by these Germans and then realize their goal. Italians, the same thing, but even the French, you would never imagine that, of course, but they were also quite optimistic that if there would be a stronger Germany, that would also be a liberal Germany, and that it would enhance France's chances of dominating, or at least playing a kind of arbiter on the European scene. So France would be the master of Europe again and have a kind of new Germany as a kind of client state, was what they thought.
On the 5th of May 2021, when the Dutch celebrate Liberation Day, Angela Merkel gave a speech in the Netherlands arguing that it was Germany's eternal responsibility to keep the memory of World War II alive. Tell us something about the German-Dutch relations today and how the Second World War plays a role in this.
Yeah, of course, the Second World War is not over in our minds. And it's very important in the Netherlands as a cultural organizer, let's say, for cultural science and how to value political attitudes, social attitudes. But the same applies very much so for the Germans, and maybe even a bit more. They've integrated the lessons of the Nazi era. With them, it's always these 12 years, not only the 5 years, of course, of the occupation of by the Germans. They've integrated those values and lessons a lot in their political culture, and especially the political classes, except of course AfD, will not really cooperate with people that don't share these values.
The party, the alternative for Germany.
So that's the big exception, because they challenge this general consensus. They are basically not considered valid partners in politics by all the others. Sometimes I think the Germans even integrate these ideas a bit more in their political life than the Dutch do, and also Dutch politicians do. You see this, for instance, when there's discussions about using violence in international politics. Germans have a very big problem with that, and although there's a push by some German politicians to go always in international and multilateral contexts, in organizations like NATO, never alone, anyhow. But when there's some push towards doing more in the abroad, cross-border, to, if necessary, also fight for peace, in the end, there is simply no majority for this because of the past. The idea that sometimes you have to militarily defend freedom is not popular in Germany. In the Netherlands, I think there's more consensus around that. Sometimes there has to be a bit of fighting to get things over. It's not really popular in the Netherlands, but there's a majority that will support that. Other example would be that Germans also have the idea that you can argue for more European integration and more international cooperation with reference to the past. To the Second World War, to the First World War, to all these violent clashes in the past.
A never again kind of narrative.
Yeah, and never again. Yeah, that's a good way to phrase it. And that, in the Netherlands, is harder to do because we don't feel responsible for that so much. In the end, we say, but we didn't start it. It was not our fault. Mathieu Segers, my colleague from Maastricht University, has pointed this out as a difficulty of, let's say, selling Europe to a Dutch audience with German arguments that will never succeed. And that's why, maybe disappointingly, Dutch politicians are a bit forced to always use these very narrow, economical, utilitaristic arguments for Europe. Does it deliver the goods? Do we earn money because of that?
Yeah, you already touched upon the role of the AfD, the Alternative for Germany party. Yeah. And my next question is about this topic.
Okay.
So the AfD was the first far-right party to win a place at the heart of Germany's democracy since World War II.
Yeah.
And I think it also has become entrenched in the German political landscape. What are your thoughts on their policies, on how they remember World War II? For example, a couple of years ago, they questioned the need for a Holocaust memorial in Berlin.
And Gauland, who was a chair of the party, who is still chair of the party, will step down in a few weeks, I think. He, for instance, said it was a birch shit on the vest of German history. Mm. So in an otherwise beautiful history, there was this small thing that went wrong. And that's it.
Yeah, what does this rise of these kind of ideas mean for how the Second World War is remembered, also in Germany, but also perhaps in the Netherlands, or in Europe?
Yeah. Well, it is some challenge. It is not really, I think, capable of winning over a majority. You never know, of course, but I don't see that already happening. A lot of people in Germany find it very strange, these kinds of thoughts about dealing with the Nazi era. But it is, of course, a challenge to be out there, especially in our media society, in which often two extremes are juxtaposed across a debating table, and as if they're equally popular. This, of course, empowers this basically weak and extreme idea, in a literal sense, also in extreme and as, let's say, marginal idea, empowers it and makes it possible to reach everybody, and maybe in a few years then attain some kind of seriousness to it. And that is a challenge, I think. Because there's such a strong consensus on how, certainly after the 1960s, German democracy is very much based on the idea that this is a fundamental break with the criminal side of German history. And because this consensus is so strong, I don't see that it will influence political attitudes so much. You see also, and that brings violence into the picture, that when it became clear the last 2, 3, 4 years that AfD fostered violent politics by people on the right, because it gave them the idea that what they thought and what they wanted to realize was basically supported by a kind of silent majority that's only suppressed by mainstream media, mainstream politics, but it's actually what people really think. Because the AfD gave these people that idea, people were put over the brink and were pushed towards violent action. This was, for instance, the case in the attack on the synagogue in Halle. This was the case in Hanau, where shisha lounges were attacked. This brought people within the Christian Democratic Party, for instance, the Union Party, finally to the point that they said, we have to really, really build a wall against AfD and against these kinds of ideas. These are not our ideas, and we cannot simply take them for granted, maybe even flirt with them here and there a bit for electoral purposes. No, we really have to state very clearly that this is not acceptable in the modern democracy that Germany has become. And this has helped, of course. And this also makes me a bit more optimist about whether this will eventually maybe break through to the majority, because it helps when people get real signals that something is not acceptable and is not part of, let's say, the normal way and of thinking and doing politics.
And how do you see the differences in the regions? I mean, it's especially in Saxony, I think.
Yeah.
There's a higher rate of people voting for AfD.
Yeah, Saxony and Thuringia, higher rate of people voting AfD. The AfD party organizations are often more extreme than in parts of the West and maybe also the northeast of the country. The so-called wing, their Flügel section of the party, which openly flirts with some National Socialist ideas, is more popular there and has official positions in AfD party there. That is in part explained by different socialization of some of the people there, especially older white men living there, because in the GDR, collectivist ideals were very important. Interestingly, intriguingly, behind a veil of internationalist cosmopolitanism, basically German national values, were cherished far more than in West Germany, certainly from the 1960s, 70s onwards. As you see in all former communist countries, there's a strong link between nationalism and communism that we often don't really see, because there's so much rhetoric about internationalism in communism. At the same time, you don't have to overestimate the differences. There's also input from, for instance, from people, extremist Germans, originating from western parts of Germany, that have also created, for instance, a kind of school on the countryside of Brandenburg, a kind of think tank, you could say, for right-wing extremists, which in this sense does not originate in East Germany, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, one of the topics you have written about a lot is political violence in Germany. You told me that a new article about this is coming up and will be published soon, somewhere this year.
Yeah.
In the journal Moving the Social.
Genau.
Genau. About violent protest in West Germany and the Netherlands in the 1960s and 1970s. Can you tell us a bit about this article?
Yeah, this article is an attempt to compare reactions to violent politics emanating from the radical left, student movement, protest movement of the 1960s, in both countries. Countries that have a very different history, but in the 1960s were, of course, also part, more or less, of the same constellation of anti-communist, pro-West, NATO membership, European integration countries. In history, the contrasts are highlighted a lot. You see, indeed, that in the Netherlands, after a few violent clashes, 1966, 67, sometimes, you very quickly see that the Netherlands succeed, so the elites in the Netherlands succeed in integrating a large part of the protest movement in, let's say, normal politics. And the Dutch system was quite open in this. And that's a contrast, as James Kennedy already pointed out, to Germany and to the United States, for instance, where there were far more of opposition to integration. The right conservative parties organized themselves far stronger against this challenge of the left and made it far more difficult to be integrated as well. We didn't have the experience in the Netherlands with left-wing terrorism then from 1970, as the Germans did with the Red Army faction. So at first instance, you say, you maybe say, what is there to compare? It's very clear that there's a lot of contrasts. So you see in West Germany a lot of terrorist actions by the Red Army faction from 1970, especially 1972, until 1977. And this creates enormous fissures in society between the whole broad environment of milieu of the radical left, let's say the post-protest movement organizations, and, let's say, established society, including, of course, the state. There's bombs going off, there's shootouts with the police, people ending up in jail, the Red Army faction very effectively continuing their political struggle from jail. So they used hunger strikes, for instance, to motivate a radical left movement. In the Netherlands, in 1977, a similar situation develops when, after three shootouts with the Dutch police, three German members of the Red Army faction end up in Dutch cells and across Dutch judges in Dutch courthouses. And then they do the same things. They also organize a prison struggle in Dutch prisons, in which they all the tricks of the book that they experienced in the 5 years prior to that, they apply to the Netherlands. This is a kind of test case of whether the Netherlands is really so much different from Germany. Yeah. And in this test case, the Dutch don't really hold up so well, because they So the Dutch police, Dutch prison officials, Dutch politicians, the only exception being maybe Dutch judges. But the other functionaries, and also the Dutch media, they more or less react with the same kinds of vigilance, the same kind of scrutiny towards the radical left, the same kind of harsh treatment of these people in prison that are, in the end, still only defendants most of the time, as they did in Germany.
Yeah.
So the interesting is that the dynamics of terrorism tickles out in all kinds of democracies, even if they're quite different in democratic societies, even if they're quite different in structure and certainly different in history, tickles out the same kind of mechanisms. That's what I wanted to highlight. There were some differences. I don't want to overstate it. And one of the differences is the security the Dutch felt in their own democratic system. For the Germans, democracy was still a quite novel experiment. They were quite insecure. They saw the Red Army faction as the first real serious challenge to this. And this caused them to overreact, I would to put it a bit bluntly. The Dutch had the idea, and especially Dutch politicians, Dutch elites, maybe it's best to discern between the Dutch population and Dutch media in general and Dutch elites. Dutch elites were not so insecure. We've got an old established democracy dating back to 1848, and we have a very rich civic culture based on liberal values that even dates back to the Dutch Republic. So we are not going to be challenged by a couple of people picking up the gun and shooting a few policemen or something.
Yeah.
So that creates, of course, some difference because they were it was beneath their honor to introduce a new law. These were murderers. How much law do you need for that? Mm. It's been in the penal code forever.
Yeah.
That murder is forbidden, and you get 20 years or more for that. So, where's the problem? And that was, of course, a big difference. Interestingly, this turned around after 9/11. You see, the Germans, having learned from this experience in the 1970s of these overreactions, they were far more doubtful of the wisdom of this war on terror, for instance, than the Dutch were. There were far more legal obstacles to implement all kinds of new laws against terrorist behavior, terrorist organizations, etc., possible attacks by airplanes, than in the Netherlands.
Perhaps one additional question to this, before we go to the last question.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you define terrorism in this context? I was asking it because sometimes states frame groups of people as terrorists.
So yeah.
how to deal with that in this academic kind of...
So I like how an historian from the United States talks about terrorism, because he says there's at least two ways to look at it, and it's very hard to define. One way to look at it is that you have to understand that it's a means of violent politics, so you want to change something in society, but it's a means that uses the communicative force of violence to, on the one side, let's say, recruit support and mobilize the people you are fighting for, and on the other side, radiate terror, so fear, through those parts of society that you want to force your political ideas on. So that's the coercive side through communication of terrorism. And that's also why I think it's very important to keep it simple and see that terror is the key.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. The other thing is, and that deals a bit with the problem that terrorism is often used as a label, a negative label, for instance, on oppositional groups in society, especially, of course, in dictatorships, but also sometimes in democracies. And that's that terrorism is also a social construct. It is a way, indeed, to label others mostly. There's only a few terrorist groups that have proudly embraced this term. And because it's a social construct, it has a lot to do with power structures in society, because it basically informs us about where opposition to power probably is situated. People that are called terrorists are not accepting the established power structures. And people that are labeled terrorists are probably labeled terrorists because they challenge authority. So a history of terrorism must always also be a history of the use of the word terrorism.
The last question.
Yeah.
If you have one, well, documentary or you have seen or book you have read which you could recommend this, perhaps it's about the RAF, but perhaps it's a total different thing. Is there something you say, oh, you should really read this or see this?
Yes.
I believe you're also a film lover.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, and I want to, indeed, it's not about Germany, it's not about the Netherlands, but it is about political violence. It's about the Brigate Rosse, Red Brigades in Italy, 1977, 78, a group similar to the Red Army faction. The film is called Buongiorno Notte, so Good Morning Night. And I like it a lot because it is... so during a kidnapping of a famous Italian and very powerful Italian politician, Aldo Moro, you follow the story of his kidnapping from the bubble of the small terrorist group of the Brigate Rosse that kidnapped him. This is so revealing, this movie, of how terrorist organizations function in the fantasy world they live in, that they derive their meaning from, and I find it fascinating. Yeah.
I will definitely watch it, and I will also put it on the website of the podcast, so
yeah,
everybody can find it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jacob Ekelder. It was really nice to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.